Log Talk Radio.
What I've left behind, you want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now radio show of NASCA, the National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. NASCA is a nonprofit 501c3 self-supporting through their own contributions. The purpose of NASCA is child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals: educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of talking about childhood sexual abuse, and presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And the other goal is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And my name is Annie Morges. I'm a NASCA family member and volunteer, and we have a special guest with us tonight. Her name is Karen Lietzel. I forgot to ask her how to pronounce it. I'm so sorry. Karen Lietzel, or Lietzel, from Silicon Valley. And Karen's mother and aunts were abused by the men in their childhood homes after the girls lost their mother to breast cancer. In 2009, she began an endless quest to understand childhood abuse when it became apparent that one of her sons was suffering greatly with intrusive thoughts and bouts of depression. She says, quite honestly, I had a very vivid dream concerning this son at a Boy Scout camp out. Of course, I wanted to be wrong about any abuse he may have suffered in Boy Scouts, but I wasn't wrong. Her family was one of many. Today, there are 84,000, the tip of the iceberg, claimants against the Boy Scouts of America. Many men abused as boys have helped us and stood by our family, she says, as we tried to find ways to help and support our son. I felt it was time for me to give back to the community of men abused as boys. So she began teaching a workshop in a men's recovery home with a curriculum to teach relapse prevention to men. And she and her husband have served there for 2 years. Her husband bakes for the men. Her workshop is called More Than Conquerors, Trauma-Informed Recovery in Christ Jesus. Serving in the home is one of her greatest joys, and the man who runs the home and the men there, she says, are amazing. And now I will say hello to Karen. Are you there, Karen?
Hi, I am. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Hello. I can hear you fine. Welcome.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'd actually forgotten that I'd written that. So, yeah, that's a nice introduction. It pretty much sums up where I'm at today. As I said mm-hmm. in my introduction that you just shared, for me, this childhood abuse was more of a symptom in my childhood home growing up as it manifested in my mom. My mom was one of three girls, and they lost their mother to breast cancer when they were 4, 6, and 8. And they were raised by two aunts that had boyfriends or, quote, uncles that lived in the home along with a grandfather. I didn't really understand the impact of that family dynamic until much later. And so anyway, fast forward, my mom falls in love with my dad. She gets married. She has, you know, four children of her own. And one of the things I clearly remember her saying to me when she started drinking was she couldn't sleep at night. She couldn't sleep until the birds started to sing. And so that's why she started drinking, because drinking helped her sleep. And so, you know, as a child growing up, you don't really know any better. You just think, okay, well, whatever helps mommy is good. And so I grew up. The one thing I think I realized in hindsight, right when I was about 20, was that my mother couldn't give hugs. Like if you went to hug her, she was stiff as a board. If you went to snuggle up to her, she'd just stiffen. And, you know, again, as a child, you don't really know any different. That's who your mother is, and she was so wonderful in so many other ways. She was a wonderful cook. She was a very dutiful mother, but the mommy piece was missing. You couldn't snuggle up into her lap. You couldn't kiss her. You couldn't. She was just very untouchable. But she did so many incredibly wonderful things for us. She made sure that we were always well fed, that we always had our dental appointments, our doctor's appointments. And, you know, really when we were in a crisis, she was right there by our side. So, you know, I didn't think much about it. That's just my childhood. And then one day she said that she was going to go into AA. And I didn't even realize that she was an alcoholic. I just figured that's what she does. I just remember she would drink at night and I would be somewhat scared about the moment of, I call it when they alter, when they go from the sweet mommy to the drunk mommy. And that was always a scary transition for me. And I had little sisters, and I used to try to get them to bed, bathe and get to bed as quickly as possible before the altered mommy would come out. So that was my late teens. And so when she entered AA's, I was about 19. And at the same time, that was like 1979-ish or so, I actually became a Christian at that point, and I was in a really sweet church where they were teaching a lot about the love of God and that God cared for us, and we had an incredible experience. So my mom was in AA's. I was going to this amazing church, and then there was this very special speaker that came, and his name was Father Brennan Manning, and he was actually a recovered alcoholic himself in AA's, and he taught us about Abba Father and the love of God. So those years were very special for my mom and me because we spent a lot of time together. I was able to go to AA meetings with her. I went to a few Al-Anon meetings with her. My dad, who was the quintessential perfect dad, really, all my girlfriends loved my dad. He was just so safe and kind-hearted. He would go to Al-Anon and they would go to AA and Al-Anon retreats together. And so life just sort of went forward and, you know, things got better because she was no longer drinking and she was happy. And I got married and I ended up being a nurse, and I worked as a nurse and I loved my job, and I worked in an intensive care nursery. And so all of that was really a pretty nice life. And my husband and I had three kids together, three boys, and it was a lot of fun. And then fast forward, when one of my sons turned 20, I noticed, well, I should say that, first of all, I got breast cancer myself when my boys were 4, 12, and 16. And I do want to take a moment to pause. And since this is Stop Child Abuse Now focused as well, I do want to tell any listeners out there that whenever a mom or a dad gets sick, be careful, because that's when predators will come and attack families. The parents, the mother's sick with chemo, with breast cancer. The children are beside themselves trying to help their mom, and predators know this, and they will pounce. And I think, like in the case of my mom, because they were orphaned, even though they were being raised by these aunts, they didn't have the watchful eye of their mother to protect them. So, I mean, honestly, I almost feel like I could say that at a breast cancer support group. In fact, I am part of a breast cancer support group. Be careful. Watch out for your children. Watch out if anybody gets too friendly. So I do want to share that just because I think what happened when I got my breast cancer, my children were 4, 12, and 16. And I'm not really sure when the predator came into our family. I'm not sure how often or how frequent. But I did realize. Now I'm done with my breast cancer. Fast forward, one of my sons, who's now 20, is pretty shut down, and I don't understand it. I'm praying to God. I'm trying to figure it all out, and then I had a very vivid dream, and in my dream, he was around 11, and he was at the beach with his Boy Scout group. And this big phantom just overcame him as he left his tent at night to just go to the bathroom. It was just this phantom. And this is when he's 20. And I've known that, really don't think, I'm not even thinking child abuse. And all of a sudden, I just knew. I thought, oh, my God, somebody's messed with my son in Scouts. So, honestly, it first came to me through a dream. And, you know, of course, you can't really trust your dreams, right? You have to test them. But I it was an overpowering feeling, and I actually mentioned it to my son, and he just took the covers and covered his head, and he was 20 at the time. And so that year, summer of 2009, my life was absolutely altered, shaken, and shattered because I knew that somebody had hurt my son. And I'm just sharing this.
What a terrible thing.
Yeah, and I know there's some mothers out there that would have never allowed any such thing to ever happen to their children. And for the longest time, I blamed myself. I thought, oh, my God, why did I ever send him to Scouts? He could have been so different. Okay. Everything could have turned out so differently, but it didn't. And then one day, I read a book. I know, but I do want to share this one thing, Bill. The one day I read this, I read this counseling book on child abuse, How to Counsel Survivors, and there was a section on there that said, for parents who didn't know, and they said something so powerful. They said, it was not your fault, and you need to role model to your children that we had a crime committed against us as a family. This was not our fault. And if you make it clear to your son that this was not your fault, that will help him understand that it's not his fault. And I, at that moment, I got that moment of clarity, and I knew this is a crime. It's the underbelly of our sick society. It's happening at a rampant rate. And I want to do whatever I can, God, to be part of the healing community. And that's actually when I started my quest, and that's when I met you, Bill, and among many others. And that started in 2009. So from that point forward, go ahead. Did you have a question?
No, I just wanted to direct you a little bit that, you know, you have a lot of time here, comparatively so, and you don't have to rush through any particular parts. So we're going to give opportunities to a couple other panelists who are with me here to maybe ask a question or make a comment, and that'll kind of pace you a little bit too, okay? Because there's no,
okay,
no
thank
rush.
You.
Okay.
Okay.
And I'm not hosting tonight. I'm on the panel, but our host is doing a great job. That's Annie, and she's doing a great job. All right?
Thank you, Bill.
And Annie, you can slow down
you.
A little too. Okay. Go ahead.
So did anybody want to ask a question on the panel?
Well, I'll make a comment. Because I am a survivor in scouting, and I'm also a survivor of I was not abused in scouting, but I know people that were. I was abused in the Catholic Church, but they were all men, so it was kind of similar. Men and boys, men and boys, men and boys, men and boys. That's what we had, and nothing else, you know, because we were in a boarding school. So I'm identifying on that basis, and I think I just want to recommend that people don't get locked into them having to be absolutely similar to what the story that is being told is. As long as you're closer, you can see, oh, that's something like what I went through. You know, just stay with it. You'll hear all kinds of things that are like you. So thanks very much for coming tonight, Karen. This is great.
Yeah, it's nice to be with you again, Bill. And I do want to say that like I shared in 2009, when I realized something had happened, I did start reaching out to people in recovery. I know that they, you know, I do depend heavily on God to direct my steps and also to help me keep a clear, honest mind. But, you know, the dream was so very vivid. And like I shared initially, no one really believed me. I mean, not that I told that many people. I just told a few people. And I'm like, oh, you can't believe a dream. And I'm like, okay, that I'll go with that. But I just sort of knew in my gut, you know, that it something wasn't right. And my son sort of confirmed it when he pulled the covers over his head. So anyway, we just continued taking it one day at a time. I did have a really close friend who's her own husband had been badly abused, and in his case, it was a stepfather in the home. And she coached me a lot. She just told me to be really careful and don't go too fast. And so I felt like a lot of people were really there for me, and they really encouraged me. And you know, things were going fine. They seemed to be going fine. My son was continuing college and got his education. You know, got his engineering degree. And so, you know, I started reading all the books that I could about it. And, you know, one person that was particularly helpful was a man named Peter Palullo. He wrote a book called Betrayal and the Beast. And when I first read that, I thought, oh, his betrayer, he's calling it a beast. But after I read the entire book, I realized that, yes, he was talking about the betrayal of him, that happened to him when he was 8, but he was also addressing the person he had become as a result of that. And he was the first one that helped me sort of put two and two together. He planted the idea in my mind that, or I shouldn't say planted the idea in my mind, his story made me come to an understanding that abuse can causes addiction, and this is a big piece of my story. And I talked to Bill Murray, my friend Bill, who runs NASCA, and he said something very, very powerful to me when I was first coming to terms with that concept. He said, it can be a reason, but it can never be an excuse for the addiction itself. And I thought, okay, that's good. But I knew my son wasn't looking for an excuse for his addiction that had developed later, but I think I was. And so anyway, that's a whole other part of my story, but back to 2009, I started just reading as much as I could to understand what does it mean when a person has experienced childhood sexual abuse and or any kind of childhood abuse? And I, as a nurse, I became very interested in the trauma piece and what it does to the brain. I was reading books like The Body Keeps the Score, going to trauma seminars, talking to survivors more than anything. And I created a whole entire library of really good works by very wonderful survivors. And one of the things, one of the books that really struck me was Boys Never Tell. And then around that same time, I read the book by a survivor of the Penn State guy. And so I just kept reading all these books and just trying to understand it as best I could, while still doing a lot of other good, healthy, wholesome things like keeping my job and being with my family. But of course, this was really, it broke my heart as a mom, and I didn't know to the extent, and I didn't understand the degree of, you know, because one of my friends said, don't push, and so I didn't. And then around 2013, things were looking pretty good for this precious son of mine, and he was engaged and he's happy. And then somebody introduced heroin to him, tar heroin. And I was like, what? I thought heroin was from the 60s. I couldn't even believe it. And so that became the new challenge that we faced. And in the meantime, where did that bring me? It brought me to a place where now I'm talking to addicts, a lot of addicts. I go to NA, I go to Narnon, I have multiple family members in addiction, and all of them are now telling me their same stories. And that's when I came to realize that, you know, I know we hear America has an opioid crisis, but I really believe with all my heart America has a childhood abuse crisis. And if you want to get rid of addiction, let's stop hurting our children. And let's find ways to let these people that were hurt as children heal. And that actually became my new passion. And not that I can change or fix my son, because the addiction piece ends up having a mind of its own. But I still had to give back. I mean, Bill spent hours on the phone with me, Bill Murray. Peter has spent hours on the phone with me. Other survivors have spent hours. Addicts have spent hours. I just thought, I can't just keep sitting here and take in, you know, help my son. I felt like I needed to give back. And that's when I started my work in Homes of Our Loving Father here in San Jose. And the reason I could work in this home is my dear friend John, who runs the home, he was abused as a boy. And he's very transparent about it. And he shares openly about it. And he was in his addiction for 40 years. I mean, he started when he was 8. He finally has like 12 years clean. And I believe 10 years ago, he started Homes of Our Loving Father. And in that home, addicted men, you know, find a place where they can have recovery if they're ready. So he and I were talking one day, and I said I wanted to serve in some way. He said, what I really need is a relapse prevention class. And then my mind went back to the very beginning of this quest when Peter Pelullo said, the reason that AA's, NA, these 12-step programs have like a third, I don't know, like a 30% success rate or whatever, I don't know the statistics, is because they're not really dealing with the root cause. And so I started making the connection between addiction and and childhood sexual abuse or childhood abuse of any sort. And that's when I created my workshop called More Than Conquerors, Trauma-Informed Recovery, with the focus being not trauma-focused, but trauma-informed, so that these men in their addiction have a safe place where they can talk freely about their trauma in a way that works for them. And so I've created an outline, and I've just used it for two straight years. It's a very simple outline. It's not complicated. And I just teach from that, and it's been such an incredible blessing. And some of the men, I think, you know, because I tell them I'm a nurse and a mom, and my husband bakes cookies at the end of my teaching time. He always gives them homemade cookies, and it's just such a sweet fellowship. And some of the men have truly shared that, yeah, that stuff happened to me too. And I said, all right, you know, that wasn't your fault, and find someone to share that with. And it's just the initial part of just being able to really share that I find is therapeutic and helpful. And I just, that's sort of where we are today. Does anyone have any questions at this point? I mean, I have more I can share, but I just don't want to keep rambling.
Bill, did you have, do any of our callers have questions?
Well, you have to ask them. We have two other callers who are on the show tonight, and one is Nancy, and the other, who's the other one? One's Nancy, and the other is? No, that's it. Nancy, and there's one from the 408 area code that I don't recognize the phone number. So I would ask Nancy if she'd like to share. And I'm trying to figure out who the 408 caller is, too. This is somebody from, I believe it would be Northern California.
Well,
so,
408
Nancy,
is my area code.
Right, Northern California. You're Central.
Yeah.
Central. Nancy, do you have anything?
Yes. Good evening, Karen. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for coming on tonight and sharing your story and being so transparent with your story. I did have a question. Did you go through sexual abuse?
No, I did not. And I consider that, I personally did not. Yeah, no.
Okay. So you did not, but you had to go through, like, learning about it and going through it with your child.
Sort of. I've talked to a couple of mothers, and I've even in one of my programs that I'm in for support for family members, and I found that some moms, they just, I can't talk about that stuff. I don't want to talk about that stuff.
Right.
And I think maybe my training as an intensive care nurse is, you know, as well as being a mom and also seeing,
right.
And also just even as a young girl, having sensed this, you know, I love my mom so much, but something wasn't right. You could just sense it. Something wasn't right.
Right.
And it just, I know sometimes I meet, maybe that's just how God births things inside of us and puts us in places so that people end up sharing, because I've really literally heard probably over 200 people share their story personally, one-on-one, first time revelation. They'll reveal to me. And even my son said, gosh, well, why do people tell you this stuff? And I said, I think it's just because I'm a nurse and nothing shocks me. And I just listen. So, you know, and I think I care a lot for children. I mean, I was 38 years working in a children's hospital. I love children. I love babies. And, you know, and I appreciate that NASCA is trying to stop child abuse, you know.
I actually,
I do believe.
I thought it was, mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. You do believe what?
Oh, no, no. I want to hear what you have to say. Go ahead.
No, I just think it's very powerful that you as a mother haven't been through that in this place that you're in right now, because a lot of times we don't get to hear from the parents who have had a child who experienced abuse. And so, like, there's a lot of children, unfortunately, who have been through child abuse, and there's probably more children that are going to unfortunately be abused. And parents, they don't know how to deal with this. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to even talk to their children. So your experience, things that you're going through as a parent, is very powerful. And, yeah, and just like
Thank
you said, you know, there's many scriptures that will back it up and say, God will, you know, everything that you've been through, things that you've been through, the good, the bad, the ugly, the saint, the hurtful, it's all going to work together for our good. And not to say that what happened was good, but what happened, you will turn it around in a good way to help other people. So you're being obedient. You're doing that. You know what I mean? A lot of people, when they go through abuse, whether you've been through physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, whatever type of abuse, and growing up with an alcoholic parent is still hard. That's not like having an easy, breezy childhood, especially when you start stepping up as an adult and trying to cover your siblings, which I'm very aware of what that's like. It's not easy. But the fact that you did that, that definitely, you know, use those parts of your life to prepare you for where you are today, every part of it, even if it doesn't make sense and it's very hurtful and it doesn't feel good. But those things that make us uncomfortable are the things that propel us to create programs, to open up ourselves, to hear other people's stories, to lend a caring ear. And those are the things that God will use to turn you around, to bring you into an area that he needs you to minister to other people. And just thank you for your obedience. Right.
Well, you're such an encourager. I really appreciate this, Nancy. The thing that I realized when I first started this journey was I was reading books, and I actually talked to an attorney, and I did a wonderful attorney, and she was going to represent my son, but he wasn't ready yet. But she's the first person that educated me, because she was like in her 60s at the time. And she had been defending, especially boys abused, or she called them, she said, they're all my boys, because when I work with them, I'm referring to a lot of times in their childhood, but they were grown men that she actually defended and won quite a few cases against the Catholic Church as well. And what she told me is that the typical abuse, the typical abuse pattern of revelation is like this. She says it's four stages. She's in her experience as an attorney, she goes in and she says, okay, let's talk about what happened. Say it like a mother picks up on it, like my case, and brings my son. The first stage is it never happened. And she said, I always say at every stage, okay, but I just want you to know that this was not your fault. A crime of pedophilia was committed against you. This is not your fault. And then she said, the second stage is, it happened, but it was no big deal. Everybody's making such a big deal of it. It's no big deal. She says, okay, but I'm telling you, a crime was committed against you, and it is not your fault. And then stage three, she says, okay, well, it happened, but it wasn't as bad as Jerry Sandusky, or, you know, or some other crazy person. And then she says, okay, it's was not your fault. This was a crime. And then finally she says the fourth stage is when the breakthrough happens, and they said it did happen and it was horrible. And then she can defend them and get, she had a really good forensic psychiatrist from UCSF that had just the right questions to ask, and then they would go into court, and most of the time they would settle out of court because she just was very successful that way. And But she was the first person that walked me through and really, I mean, I had sat there and took notes the entire time I was talking to her. So I do feel like, you know, so many people were so kind to come alongside of me. And like I said, even, you know, Bill was a big friend. I mean, I was, he never made me feel bad when I would call him and pester him and ask him more questions. Never, not once did he make me feel like, oh, it's Karen again, you know, talking about her son again. You know, never once. He just kept saying, we're a family, we're a family, we're a community, we can do this, we can fight, you know, we can be there for each other. And yeah, I mean, and I also have to say that honestly, in my experience now since 2009, and even thinking back to my mom, survivors are incredible human beings. They have a tender heart. They're sensitive. They can pick up on things. I mean, like, my son is so sensitive. I mean, he picks up on, as it turns out, my breast cancer came back. I have stage 4 now, but he, you know, 19 years later, he's so intuitive. Like, even as a child, he wouldn't just say, oh, mommy, I have breast cancer. His first question is, well, how many lymph nodes are involved? I mean, this is coming out of the mouth of a 12-year-old child. And so I guess my word of encouragement is the way that my experience with people that have been wounded this way as children is they are exceptional human beings. And my biggest desire is to pull as many people that have suffered as children that are living in the cave of shame and to do whatever I can to encourage them to come out, to eject the lies in their heads about themselves and believe truly that God heals, God loves them, God uses loving community, and if they're addicted, he does use the 12 steps. It's a good program. And they do have a purpose that's filled with peace and joy. And that's what I've been doing in the home. And the men have taught me so much. And some have come up afterwards and said, yeah, that happened to me too. And one gentleman in particular, last summer in the workshop, he finally told his wife, and it's like this massive weight lifted from him, and he no longer has the desire to drink, and he's joyful, and he's happy, and he's living a good life. And I don't know, that just to be any small part of that is a huge blessing for me. So, yeah.
Well, with a lot of people who've been through abuse, they do go into addiction. And the reason for that is because, you know, it helps you to get numb. It helps you to forget. It does help you to sleep. It helps you. I used to have a lot of night terrors and flashbacks. Yeah. And so those things were just very triggering for me. I would wake up every single night in cold sweats. And I was like, my body was like reliving some of these situations. And this happened to me as an adult, okay? So it happened, I went through that stage as a teenager, then I was doing better, then I went through the stage as an adult, and I didn't understand why, but I think definitely it's very important for us to educate ourselves. I love the fact that you're reading, you're searching, and you're educating yourself. So that's very important for parents to know, parents who have been through that, who have had children who've been through abuse, to, you know, to read and educate yourself. I think a lot of times people tend to want to just act like it didn't happen and, you know, and block it out, and they don't know how to approach it. They haven't educated themselves on how to initiate the conversations or how to, you know, they don't feel like they're a psychiatrist or a psychologist or they're at that level where they can engage with someone who's been through that abuse because they don't want to say the wrong things. But really, it's so awesome that you took the time to educate yourself, and you already just you know, have a background of education, but, you know, you took that step to educate yourself in that particular area. And from that, God has placed a ministry inside of you where now you're helping people and you're teaching this program. I just think that's amazing.
Thank you. Well, I do have to say that women like you, I mean, have helped me, because in the very beginning when I realized how, I mean, I'm going to say that childhood sexual abuse is life-threatening, okay, because it can create suicidal ideations, and I'm now speaking from experience as an observer, and it's life-threatening. And so I was beside myself. So I actually went to a 12-step program in Willow Glen. I was at a little church, and I called the lady about the leader of it and asked if I could come. I said, it didn't happen to me myself, but it happened to one of my children. And, oh, she said, oh, yeah, come. And she was the leader. She was so loving. And I went into – I was in this room, and there were, like, 8 women sitting around. And inside, in the middle of the room, there were these big stuffed animals. And she said, okay, if anybody – oops, we're going to start – and it was a 12-step program. We're going to start, so if anyone needs to grab a stuffed animal, feel free. So a lot of the women would grab their stuffed animals, and they just hold them. And these were women – this is from Silicon Valley. So they were a principal of a school, an editor, an engineer, these were all women in different walks of life with different, you know, a homemaker, a waitress, you know, they were all working. They were all functioning out there in society in terms of what we see as functioning. But inside, they were still trying to heal from what happened to them as a child. And so when I was in that room with them, and then it was my turn to share, every single one of them turned around, and I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe, you know, I mean, I haven't had it happen myself, but, you know, gosh, these women, they all loved on me. And that's going to make me cry. They all loved on me. They all said, thank you for coming. And one of them even said, I can't even imagine if this happened to my own child. I never even thought about that. And then, you know, at the very end, the woman leading the group, and I know this sounds, this is where being involved with people that have suffered, giver, and expands your heart and just opens it up to so much love. The woman that was leading the group, who was so friendly and sweet, she says, thank you so much. This place is so safe for me. It's where I don't have to blend all my personalities. So she was a multiple. She had multiple personality disorder. She was married. She struggled, but she felt safe there among other survivors to just be who she is. And I just gave her a big hug, and I just thought, wow. I felt like I was on holy ground, honestly. I was like, we're just people on this earth, you know, we're good people trying to help one another, you know, survive this trauma of childhood. And again, I feel like the healing community is exceptional, and that working in the men's home is beyond amazing. They're sweet, they're tender, they're men. And so I really do feel like what God has put on my heart, you know, because I have girlfriends that have had things happen to them, and nieces, and I've had friends that have had, but I feel particularly my focus is, you know, I'll talk to anybody, but, and I want to hear anybody's story, but addicted men wounded as boys. And that's where I think that's why God opened this door for us to work in homes of our loving Father with my friend John. And, yeah, so that's a bit more of my story. Does anyone have any comments?
Well, you know, Well, you know, Karen's here because, you know, she and I had quite a few phone calls, and I know her pretty well, but I haven't heard from her for in a while. However, I jumped at the opportunity to have somebody who has her background come on the show, because I don't think it's just survivors of child abuse who have the answers. I think we need to represent the mothers and fathers and uncles and whatever, and maybe priests and brothers and teachers and cops, you know, because they all have something to contribute too, and they're all they're all not responsible, but may think they are, you know, from the get-go, and they're not. So they need to learn this. Karen, I'm really appreciative of the fact that you came on. You explained that very well, and I think everybody here is very happy that you came. And you sound great, by the way. How'd that happen?
Well, I think, you know, friends like my friend Bill and my friend Peter and, again, survivors, they said, make sure you take care of yourself. Self-care is really important. And I think that's true for all of us, right?
Right.
So, you know, I found, you know what, I think the biggest thing is in the beginning when you're a mom and you find something has happened to your child and then you realize now they're a heroin addict, you'll do anything to save them. I mean, you'll do anything. You'll step. You'll take a bullet. You'll step in front of a truck. You'll go into the scariest parts of town, you know, breaking into houses looking for them. I mean, you lose your mind, really. And when you lose your mind, you'll do anything to save your child. And that's just the way. That's the way I think most mothers are wired. But now I've come to a place where it's just part of who I am. You know, this is just part of our story. And I thank God for all of the, you know, I call them survivors, fires. I actually call them more than conquerors. I like that better because we're more than conquerors. And what I have found was I tell the men in the home, I say, I'm actually very excited to see how our culture is having the conversation more frequently. And they're also looking at PTSD. They call it, you know, PTSD, which is basically what trauma causes. And they're looking at the brain and they're studying the MRI. And I find that when I can bring that kind of factual information into the lives of the men by, you know, looking at like more than, the body keeps the score. When people can understand what their body's doing when it's triggered, that's a class that I teach, triggered. And it was really, really, it's been really fun, you know. So one day I brought to the class with the men, I brought a big, huge, huge, like, suitcase, and I put all these things in it that I thought could possibly be triggers. And I said, now listen, guys, if you get triggered, raise your hand and say stop. And they called me Auntie Karen, stop. But it didn't turn out that way. And so I brought something like I brought a because, you know, I'm a mother of sons, I brought like a gorilla. And they were like, oh, that's the monkey on my back. And I go, good. And then I brought an empty vodka bottle. And I go, what does this do? And then they just started talking about triggers. And I even brought a woman's purse. And one guy responded exactly like I thought. He goes, oh, that reminds me of my old lady's purse where I used to steal money to get my dope. And then I put in a whip, and like a bull whip. And one guy actually said, oh, that my dad used to use that on me. And so what I did that purposefully, because before I taught the class, I said, I believe that God created us in his image, which is he's intelligent. So if we can learn about what trauma actually does to the physical body, when we're triggered and we feel it, we can actually step back from it. And there's like a 5-step process. We feel it. We step back from it. We now, as in the stepped back position, we look at it. And then we ask ourselves, what caused me to have that feeling to go out? I want to go, I want to go shoot up, or I want to go, you know, drink a sip of vodka. What caused that? And then, so you're aware of it. And I said, and then the fifth thing is share it. Tell somebody, tell a brother, tell your sponsor. And that's the way we retrain the brain so that we're no longer controlled by the triggers, but we have control over the triggers. And it's a process, I realize. And I'm not speaking from personal experience. Well, in some ways I am, though, because I have been traumatized by a lot of this stuff. You know, moms get traumatized too, secondhand, but not as bad as in no comparison, really. But so that class on triggers, you know, again, it came through some research, and I thought, well, I got to teach this to the guys. And they were so receptive. And guys farther along in the recovery were able to say, you know, they just, and I make it a workshop. And that's the best part, because I say, we're all in this together, you guys, okay? We're all in this together. We're on this earth together trying to figure out the best way to help each other be the, to fulfill our purpose and have peace and joy. And so I start with a lesson, and then I let them take it away. And I even have like a clipboard, and I make, and I like see there's 15 guys in the home, and I have them each write their name down. And you know, that has been one of the best tools that I've used in my workshop, because they all write their name down. And in the beginning, you know, they didn't really want to share, but now they all share. But I would say, okay, I'd say, I'm going to pick number 6. And I'd look at the name, Jose. And then all the guys would go, oh, Jose. You know, and then Jose would share. And I go, okay, you can pick a number, Jose. And he'd go, 12. He goes, okay, Miguel. And all of 15 shared. And now I don't even hardly have to use the numbers. They like to share. And that's a big part of recovery, is using your own voice to say how you feel and what you're feeling. You know what I mean?
Right. Wow. So is your son currently, where's your son now?
Well,
he
still struggles with the disease of addiction. And so he's just where God has him right now. And he's not in recovery. So we just keep praying and having hope and faith that, you know, he too shall, you know, find his healing.
Right.
But, you know, it's, I tell the men, I said, you know, I said, I'm not here. I don't do this. I didn't feel, my husband and I said, we're not doing this because we're, you know, we're hoping that, okay, God will see and then maybe he'll bless us and our son will get better. No. This is independent of our son working in the men's home. This is our way of giving back, because we have been so blessed by other survivors and other people in recovery that have poured into our lives. I mean, Bill can testify to that. I mean, he did spend lots of time talking to me, you know, and so have many others. So that.
Hey, Karen.
I'm
sorry. This is Annie. I was just going to step in and say hi. Hi.
Hi.
You know, I was interested in hearing about the curriculum you wrote to prevent relapse. I understand that the triggering and the sharing are things that you did. Are there any other techniques that you use to help people not relapse?
So John, my friend John, who has more, who has Homes of a Loving Father, he's, you know, a Christian, and he realized, you know, he's been doing the home for a long time. And his big thing was in the beginning was he said, you know, I really want to make sure these men have a relationship with God. And after doing it for a while, he realized that, you know, when an addict is out there under the bridge or in a homeless shelter, you know, in a homeless walk in the streets at night, he's calling out to God. He's got a relationship with God. the big thing is when they come into the home, you know, addiction is one of those diseases where relapse is part of recovery, and he wanted to just see less relapse. So that's when he asked me, you know, we talked together, and I said, well, I would love to maybe try teaching a relapse prevention class. And he said, yeah, let's do that. And the reason I can work so freely with John is because he takes full responsibility for his addiction years. In other words, like his daughter has spoken in the home and said, when my dad was out there using, this, this, and this happened to me, and he'll stand right up and say, guys, I put that in my daughter. He resonated with me because of what Bill had told me before I even met John. It can be the addiction piece. The abuse is definitely the reason, but it can't be the excuse for the addiction piece. Because, and Bill said something so powerful. He said, the same piece inside of us, or the same process inside of us that fights the addiction, is the same thing that we're going to need to heal from our childhood abuse. And he said to me, Karen, you can't make that happen for your son. And I thought, okay, I get it. I hear you. And so with John, I saw that fleshed out in terms of how he takes full responsibility for what the addiction piece created, but yet he's fully transparent about, you know, the beatings that started when he was two and all the other stuff that happened to him. And so I started what I created was More Than Conquerors, Trauma-Informed Recovery in Christ Jesus. And so I have it. It's a very simple outline. It's, I call it the path. That's one section. The truth. And then the third section, the future. And it's so simple. The past is, number one, trauma. Two, cave of shame. Three, addiction. So I say to the men, a trauma happened. It shoved you into the cave of shame. And because we're created to have community, we pull ourselves out of the cave of shame, maybe at age 12, and we smoke that first joint, and then people think we're funny, or we drink a little, and then the anxiety goes away, and I can actually go to a party, because we're meant to be with people. That's why I love that Bill's focus is, this is a family, this is a community, because building community is what builds recovery. So that's when the addiction kicks in. So let's face it, nobody would have been an addict if it didn't provide some sort of relief. The fact that you became an addict doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you were looking for relief, but it didn't work. It has an end point. It works for a while maybe, but then the next thing you know, the man takes the drink, then the drink takes the man, right? And so that's the past. But then I say the next section is the truth, and I don't call it the present. I say it's the truth because we need it for the past. And it is what launches us into our future. And the truth has four points to it. God loves me. God heals me. Number three, God uses loving community like you've all created. Number four, and remember, this is addiction we're talking. God uses the 12 steps. So this is an addiction recovery, you know, home. So I do believe that God uses the 12 steps. I think they're really helpful. And so then the future is purpose, peace, and joy. And so a lot of times what I like to do is I like to bring, I've done it a couple of times, where I'll bring addicts that are in recovery and now are living really purposeful lives. I mean, one of my favorite speakers in our home is one of my dearest friends, and he was like in prison, three strikes and you're out, and lots of trauma from his childhood, addiction, you know, on and on, ended up in prison, But you know what? He got recovery in prison, and he's like 12 years clean as well, and he's been done wonderful, wonderful work with gang prevention in the town he's from. He sponsors so many men constantly, and he's been one of my dearest friends. So, again, you know, that's my outline. And then as far as the bone, that's kind of the bones, and some of the flesh that I put on is like on last Monday, we just looked at two worship songs that talked about how God loves us. And we just listened to them, looked at the lyrics, and then I just simply said, okay, so what part of this song meant something to you? And each of the men shared on both songs. And I think the reason that I really focus on wanting the men to share and talk and use their own voice is because in that book, The Body Keeps the Score, the doctor who wrote that book, who's like one of the top doctors in trauma, and he does a lot of great trauma workshops, there's a section in the book, and this is Bessel van der Kolk, MD, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. One day I was just praying. I was going, God, why doesn't my son use his voice? I need to hear his voice. And then I just opened to the section, and it said that it describes the physiology of trauma in the brain. And when that trauma first happens to a child, it's like a stroke. There's an area in the brain called the Broca area, B-R-O-C-A, and the Broca area of the brain creates speech and language. And so when a child gets abused, it's like they've been shocked, and that area is affected. And part of that's why you've heard over and over, the person needs to tell their story. They need to get their story out. Well, what is it about that? What it is that they're using their words, and that area of their brain can start to heal. So with that concept in mind, that's why my major focus in the workshop is just to get the men to share and to talk and to hear their voice. And I love it. I learned so much from them. So that's one of the things that was what I just did on Monday. We listened to really good songs, two excellent songs, and then we discussed them.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with what you're saying about the sharing being so healing for the men. I really think in my life, I'm a survivor of childhood sexual assault, and sharing with other survivors and listening to other survivors share, that is what healed me, that helped me heal over the years, knowing I wasn't alone. I'm sure that your men look at one another and go, wow, you too, you know, because so many of us have these child abuse backgrounds. So I just wanted to say that. And let's see, is there anyone else who has a question for Karen this evening? No? Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let's no questions. You've been so so you've covered all the corners.
Are you listening? Do you have a question? You want to ask a question? My husband's listening. He's the 408 number.
Oh.
So
I
thought, yeah, I said, okay, yeah, good. Do you want to ask a question?
He's shaking his head.
He bakes the cookies for our group. Do you want some homemade chocolate chip cookies? I wish I could share them with you. He's really good at it.
Well, that's being a service. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a really good one, because that's one thing I definitely learned as a nurse. You know, when you go to in services or anybody's trying to teach you anything, the nurses always said to Jen, did they bring food? And so I said, Dave, you have to make food for the guys. It'll keep them. it's funny. They're so cute because after the workshop's over, Uncle Dave brings out his cookies and they grab them and go have their, you know, it's just the best. Anyway.
That's such a comforting gift to make cookies.
Yeah, right? Cookies. Who doesn't like a good old-fashioned chocolate chip cookie? So
yeah.
I'm thinking, I was trying to think something else. Since I know we have a little more time, one of the things I thought would be helpful to share is I really do want to give honor and support. I want to give honor to the organization called Abused in Scouting. And what they did, I don't know if anybody knows how they went about it, but there's a particular, their main attorney that started the whole process. Anyway, it grew. And so what they did was they didn't have a lot of money initially, so they would do these little infra commercials, like at really cheap times on television, like 2 a.m. in the morning or, you know, or some random, you know, times where it was real cheap to get the commercials out there on the television. And so that's how they started it. And they started because the one attorney had represented so many boy or men that were abused in Boy Scouts of America that he became like a David against a Goliath, right? And he ended up growing this Abused in Scouting organization. So I have to say, I didn't know anything about it, but my son happened to see it on an infra commercial and he sent it to me. And then one of my closest friends sent it to me. And at that point in my life, I was like, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, I mean, I'm powerless. This is for you. But you know what happened was I just woke up one morning and I thought, well, maybe I'll call them anyway because maybe I should talk to them. And I talked to them and I told them our situation. And I said, you know, if my son did put in a claim, I would probably have to come alongside of him to help that process because of the addiction piece. And they were like, oh, no, that's fine. We appreciate that so much. And in fact, 90% of our claimants are in your exact same situation. And I was like, 90%? He goes, yeah. Some kind of struggling with addiction, and they were so supportive. The attorneys were so loving and so caring, and I really liked the format that they used. What they used, which made it so much easier for the men abused in scouting, is they had they did it all online, and they sent what do you want to call it? Not an interview, but a questionnaire about your experience. And so I sat with my son and he did it. But what I had now, this was just like last summer, what I realized was what a absolutely wonderful tool for getting this, for helping these young or helping these men get the story out, right? They didn't actually have to talk about it. They just had to type it. And then they had good attorneys to look it over. And I mean, it sounds, I don't know. I learned, I thought, oh, these people care so much. They really, truly care. And by the time they closed the ability to sign up for this class action lawsuit, they had 82,000 claimants. So this is notes that I took on 10/21/21 from Abused in Scouting because I talked to one of the attorneys again. And they'll take my call anytime. They'll talk to me. They'll comfort me. They're very analytical. They're very solid in their minds. They're passionate for helping. But they said that there was, this is from the attorney, they had like a deadline that courts told them, because basically what Boy Scouts of America wanted to do was go into bankruptcy, because so many individual attorneys were going after them that they just said, let's just go in bankruptcy. And if they go to bankruptcy court, then anything that happened, they can rebuild after that point, and they no longer have to have any lawsuits. So anyway, 82,000 claimants. And so I guess the Boy Scouts of America have $5 billion in assets. And So what they used, what they developed was, and again, I appreciate this as a nurse. There's no way you could ever put a matrix around something like abuse because it's so individual. But they did, for these claimants, develop what was called an abuse matrix based on five factors. And all of them have impact in the life of their claimants. But I just thought that just their ability to, I don't know, I feel like in the beginning when we were learning about all these children being abused, it's sort of like when you come across a toxic dump, you know, you're like, what the heck? What has happened? Where is this coming from? And then you get really caring people that come along and say, wait a minute, this is how you heal. This is this. They start, as intelligent people, we start putting structure around prevention. Yeah, this is it. Structure around prevention and structure around healing and structure around creating safer environments. So I like what Abused and Scouting has done for the community of those hurt as children. And I just want to give them like 10 minutes of, like I just shared, of gratitude and thankfulness.
What's the name of the organization again?
It's called Abused in Scouting. You can just look it up. And there's wonderful attorneys that they're just basically people that really care. They don't like these crimes. And the thing is the claimants were ages 5 to 90.
Oh.
And they also said it was like the 82,000 was probably about 10% of those that had been abused. And one of the attorneys said, without being hyperbolic, because this attorney, I great doc, his name is Keller. He said, without being hyperbolic in my language, he said that Boy Scouts of America is the largest boy pedophile ring in the history of man. Now, that's just what he shared. I'm just quoting him, and he shared that on like news channels around the news, just because of the amount of information that he had. So back in 2013, when I realized something, well, 2009, I just cried out to God. Honestly, I just cried out. I said, God, please stop this. Please stop this. And so to me, whatever ends up happening in terms of our case, I don't know. And it doesn't even matter. It's not about the money. It's about the fact that, it isn't. I don't even know what's going to end up happening in that area with the courts. I'm so grateful that another organization is fighting for children and fighting for healing, called Abused and Scouting.
Karen, I have a question.
Yeah, it's been
for
a journey.
You.
Okay.
The person who was responsible for the abuse of your son, is he in prison now?
So the thing about Boy Scouts of America is they have, so no, we don't know who he is. We don't know. It's very hard to pinpoint, because the Boy Scouts of America, kid, since their inception in the early 1900s, the Boy Scouts of America hid their pedophiles. They knew they had pedophiles in their ranks. They knew that their organization was unsafe for children, but they would just, if a child or a family complained, they wrote it up in a little filing cabinet that had become known as the perversion files, and they held and they kept them and held them in their the basement of their I mean, if you Google perversion files of Boy Scouts of America, you'll be shocked. There's so many, but they hid them. So that was that's the main thing, is that they didn't let, they should have always had a disclaimer that said, you know, welcome to Boy Scouts of America. We try our best to keep pedophiles out, but we've had 100,000 boys abused in the last 10 years. So, you know, just beware. You know, it's like, it's so diabolical that the way they hid it for money is so, you know, of course they didn't want anybody to know. So they just kept it in their files. They didn't report it to local police. They didn't share with other family members. They didn't, I would have, you know, if I had known that they had this history, I would have never had any of my children in Boy Scouts.
No.
And they just, I mean, anyway, that's just the facts. Those are just the facts, the ugly facts.
I've never heard of
that. But you know what?
Files. I'm going to look those up.
Yeah, those states that the first
it reminds me
files,
a lot of what the. It just reminds me a lot of what the church did. They knew about it, but they didn't let other people know about it, like the police.
Yeah. And I have to say that, that being said, I mean, I was a cub mom myself. I started my own little Boy Scout group with a group of us who homeschooled our youngest children. I didn't know, you know, I mean, and the majority of leaders in the scouting program love kids and they're good people, just like there's a lot of really, really wonderful priests out there. But the problem is when the organization hides the truth, that's the problem. And they're doing it for money, you know, and they just don't want the bad press. That's bad. That's bad. That's bad. And, you know, and thankfully more and more whistleblowers are speaking out and more people are demanding truth. So, and attorneys like these abused in scouting, that's what they're called. It's the organization, are fighting the good fight, you know, for these children and grown men to find healing. So,
yes.
So abuse
there's
and
a lot
scouting
of hope out
is
there.
Like they have like
it's
lawyers on staff?
Oh, yeah, lots of lawyers. Abused and Scouting.
Okay.
Abused and Scouting is an organization of multiple attorneys that started and how they got their claimant, they didn't have a lot of money when they started. They just put advertisements out there on like I said, 2 a.m. in the morning when they could get TV time that was super cheap. And, you don't hear too much about it, you know, but at least there's a lot of good people out there,
yep.
trying to fight for the children. And NASCA is one of them, a huge organization towards that, trying to help others. And, you know, and
that's
just, I appreciate that. And I do appreciate the healing that comes from interacting with warriors for our children, you know, and for our families. It's a good group of people. I mean, those attorneys, so many times when I call them, they were just, we talk and just right there. I pick up the phone right there, pick it up. Never once did they push me off. No, I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
I know, caring. I'm telling you, there are a lot of caring people out there. So that's who we have to keep seeking, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
and
we need
have
an army
to keep speaking
for them.
Aloud to
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like the works of a man named Victor Mark, and his big thing is help. He works. He formed an organization against the sex trafficking of children in America. So there's a lot of good going on. I think it's hard. It's a hard conversation. I think adults that, like Bill, who shared freely with me, gave me so much hope. You know, we all need hope, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially hope in God, you know, that he sees, he's like at one point it was like, oh, I was like, God, why did you allow this? Why do you allow it? And I stop it. And he goes, why don't you help? And I just kind of like, okay, I hear you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I mean, we still do other fun things. We, you know, we go out for nice meals. I love to garden. I take care of myself the best I can. I love to walk. You know, I try to eat healthy. But I'll talk to somebody about something that happened to them when it's a kid, anytime, any place. And if it helps them,
mm-hmm.
That's a good day for me.
That's wonderful.
So are you.
Yeah, there are a lot of good people. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we've got about 7 minutes left. Bill, did you have anything that you wanted to ask Karen about or to say about our conversation?
Well, now, I want to make a point, though, that, you know, a lot of these organizations, they have this, somebody said it earlier, they have similar patterns of behavior where they, for example, they're aware that the abuse goes on, but they hide it in one way or another. In the Boy Scouts case, you know, they made a blacklist, and they moved these men around. So, you know.
Exactly.
Even if they found somebody in one area, they just let them have another troop somewhere else. So that's one
exactly.
way of doing it. The church did something very similar. But here's the point I want to make, not really about those individual places, but about the collective of them that exists. There are many. And we used to do a show once a month, on institutional abuse and enabling. That was what it was all about. And we used to cover on one case, you know, the church, another, the Boy Scouts, but also Penn State with Sandusky, with also foster care systems. At the time, it was Arizona. It was terrible. We covered the family court system, the medical community, on and on and on. There are groups of people who do deal with children who have offenders among them, and they... The administrators and the older people in these groups know it. There was a group in Boys Town a few years back that they wrote about. You know, I mean, come on, everywhere, and
everywhere.
So there's a lot of work to do. Okay, a lot. It really relies on adults taking back the control. You know, healthy adults taking back the control from the ones that are, even if they weren't perpetrators, they're hiding it, and that makes them guilty too, you know. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that it's not only Boy Scouts and it's not only the church. It happens everywhere. It happens in all
mm-hmm.
churches, for example. You know, it happens
all
in the Mormon
churches.
Church.
Right, you're right, you're right.
Jeez. You know, and it happens overseas. It's a worldwide, this is why I call it a worldwide pandemic. That truly affects everyone.
It is the pandemic. One friend said to me, it's the underbelly of our sick society, and until people are willing to look at it and fight it, it's going to continue.
That's correct.
And that's just the way it is. And so if I end up being the person at the party that nobody wants to talk to, I know there'll be someone, because sometimes I just, mm-hmm. You just feel like, no, this, the most of the time, one thing I do have to say is part of what I ended up focusing on more is I know I'm a nurse. I'm not a police officer. Yeah, I'll tell the truth, because I am a nurse and I am a mom, but I really had to focus on recovery. And that's what I liked about that book, The Body Keeps the Score, because at the last third of the book, he talks about ways of really practical ways that people get better, like through journaling or poetry or dance therapy or, you know, just all these ways that the brain heals. I guess being a nurse, I'm most comfortable. I know this problem exists. I see where it exists. I just want to help people get better. How can I do that? How can I be part of that healing community?
It sounds like you're a big part of the healing community.
Yeah, I think if you approach it like that, you're going to be able to find easily things to do. It's the people that's why we got to shake people up a little bit so they can pay attention. Because it's happening
right
under our noses. It's right on our streets.
Right. And
it's down the block. You know?
Yes. Exactly. Yes. And how much better if we never had to be healed from it from the first place if it was prevented? Right?
I have no idea,
right,
because my life has been a mess of trauma. You know, it's been a mess. It still is. You know, but it's had great consequences, not just the body, but the education I got, the career I had, the relationships I had, all those things keep the score. They all keep the score, you know,
yep,
because
yeah,
there are consequences,
yeah,
of being a child who, or an adult who experienced abuse as a child and lives in a state of trauma, which we all do. Even when we deal with it, we still live in it. We're
yeah,
better, no question. But it doesn't disappear. It doesn't go away. It becomes the basis of the rest of our life. That's what I believe.
Yep.
And as far
I've heard that many times.
I've had a lot of time in recovery now, and it doesn't go away. You know, it just doesn't go away. So we're the lucky ones because we have each other. And although we may form only 1% of the people that would be eligible for what we have, we are the 1%, whatever it is, 2%, 3%. We're the tiny little representation, but we are there. So we should be grateful, too. And out of that gratitude, then take the actions that are needed to help others. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah,
right.
No, you've
helped
me a lot, Bill. Thank you.
Welcome.
My
privilege, of course.
I really do appreciate it. Gosh, really. Another friend who scraped me off the kitchen ceiling at times, you know? You're like, oh, my gosh.
Well, listen, we're at the end of the show here, and our host is going to have to play the music when it counts down. But I'm sure she agrees with me. Well, she can say it herself, but we are really grateful, Karen, that you made this date and came on. And you're welcome back anytime. You know you're a member of the NASCA family, so you know.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, it's a pleasure
to be a
member. Thank you, all of you. Thank you, Annie.
Thank you,
Nancy.
Everyone.
Yeah. Good job, Annie.
That's good
thank
job.
You.
Yeah, God bless you all.
We'll see you tomorrow night, too. We've got those 5 nights a week. Thank you, Annie. You did a great job.
Thank you, Bill.
Blog Talk Radio.